Welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. Dr. Peter Blundell interviews therapists about their work and experiences within the therapist community.
Hello, and welcome to the Therapist Connect podcast. My name is Dr. Peter Blundell, and today I'm interviewing Elizabeth Terp, who is a therapist and counsellor who lives and works in Liverpool. She's also written a book which supports family and friends of individuals who have chronic fatigue syndrome. And it's lovely to have her here on the podcast today. Oh, it's lovely to see you face to face. Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Brilliant. Okay, well, we'll crack on then. I've read a little bit about you on your website and everything, but I suppose could you tell the people who'll be listening how you came to be a therapist, really, and what kind of drew you to the profession?
Okay. Yeah, well, it was one of those where I always sort of felt like I knew what area I wanted to go into, but I didn't know what the job that fitted that was, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I, like lots of people in my family, are things like teachers and nurses and all of that. So I knew it was something in that area, but it wasn't till I went to university. I did a combined degree, English and psychology. And then in my final year, you have to pick the options. And I picked counselling psychology. And I was like, that's it. That's what I want to do. And it was just absolutely brilliant. But obviously, I was quite young at that point because I went straight from school to university. So it was a little bit too soon to kind of train and go forward. So after that, I did a bit of voluntary work. I knew I needed to test myself. So I went and worked for victim support. So I volunteered with them because I wasn't sure at that point whether I had some of the toughness required to do the work that we do. And I know you'll understand what I mean by that. So just, you know, could I cope with it basically? Could I take some of the distressing stuff? So I did that and I found out that I had more skills in that area than I thought. And I did work my way up through that, and then did other bits of voluntary work. And then I was quite young when I started training to be a counsellor. So basically as soon as they let me do it, I did it. So I was only 24 when I started. I know there's a lot more younger people coming through now, but this is 22 years ago. So it was less usual for there to be younger people when I started.
And I think at one point, some of the courses, didn't they restrict as well, I think? The age limit, really. So that's not really the case now. But
yeah, you had to work quite hard to get on it if you were my age, certainly. Yeah. But they let me on, and it was great.
Fantastic. Yeah. So you've been doing it for 22 years.
I know, I can't even believe it. I just can't believe that. It's one of those, just weird. But yes, I have, it's true.
Which is fantastic. So yeah. Can you tell me a little bit, obviously that's when you qualified. Can you tell me a little bit about your career then
So when I was training, I was still working for Victim Support because I was managing one of the schemes. So I got a bit of funding in and we did like a side project with a bit of counselling there. And then my next job was supposed to be a counselling job. So I was working in a drop-in centre with homeless people, but it didn't quite work out like that because anyone who knows Maslow's hierarchy of needs knows that there's a lot more needs that people need when they're in that situation before therapy. So it was a really great job, but there wasn't a huge amount of therapy going on in the role. Just wasn't right. So then I was lucky at the time because I managed to get a job in the NHS. So this was 6 years or so before IAP. So I actually got a job in a counselling service in the NHS in Knowsley, and it was absolutely brilliant. It was the dream for, obviously, I'm sure we'll get on to talking about this, but for any newly qualified counsellor, is to get a full-time paid job in counselling, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got one in the NHS. And at that stage, because I hadn't really had a proper therapy job before that, as I say, because the jobs I had hadn't really allowed for enough face-to-face work. And so to be in a team of experienced counsellors who were nurturing and brilliant and, you know, let you work autonomously, but then there's always someone there to sort of support you and guide you. It's like absolutely perfect. What could anyone need more than that at that stage in your career?
Yeah.
So that was great, and it continued to be great. And then IAPT came in. And so it did change after that. And I'm not going to go off on one too much about that, but just say, so I worked in the NHS for another 6 years after IAPT, and I ended up leaving for various reasons, you know, not just because of the way that went, but a large part of it was I didn't feel like I could work there anymore, which I was very sad about, actually, because I really do believe in the NHS, and my aim would have been to stay in the NHS for my whole career, but it just wasn't viable for me to do that. And so I left.
So it was quite a big thing for you to leave then, if you were kind of very committed to it. And yeah,
it was horrible. And I should have left a lot earlier than I did. And we'll get on to probably talking about other stuff. But I also had some quite serious health problems around that time. So it was a case of, because other people said, oh, it was brave of you to leave. But actually, it was necessary. I had to, in order to continue to do the work that I love to do and look after myself, I had to leave, and so I did, and that was 7 years ago now, and I left, and I've been in private practice ever since, and it's just fantastic. I mean, I didn't know what it would be like, and I was scared about what, you know, what would I feel like completely at sea, or, you know, would I miss the support, or what, you know, basically it's all the good stuff and none of the bad stuff. it's
quite liberating, isn't it?
It's wonderful. I'm so grateful for it. It's just really great. So I've been doing that ever since.
Fantastic.
I'm quite proud of the fact that because I believe in people being able to access help and not pay for it, a third of my work is working with people who aren't actually paying for their own therapy. So I've got various different routes that I've managed to establish either with companies or EAPs or private medicals or whatever. So at least a third of my clients don't pay for their therapy, which I'm pleased about because, as I said, I believe in the NHS and I didn't want to completely leave that model behind.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So it's okay. It sits okay with me now.
And so how long have you been in private practice for then?
Seven years. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, yeah. It's quite a while, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? It's gone really quick, actually. Yeah. I think what I didn't know was all the things that you need to kind of get that off the ground quite quick I'd already done. Because in the NHS, they make you do all manner of additional training, obviously. I'd done my accreditation. I'd done a master's in counselling before I was in the NHS even. So I kind of had a lot of things which I didn't need to do as much as I thought I would need to do to set myself up, put it that way. So
some of
the work just came to me, and then, you know, I built on the other stuff. And it's been a lot.
Fantastic. And it sounds like to do that transition, you had, like you say, you had quite a lot of things in place that you weren't even aware of.
That actually
came to be useful moving into private practice.
That was really satisfying because obviously a lot of those things I'd put a lot of hard work and effort into, you know, and in the NHS they weren't appreciated really at all. But in the outside world, I mean, that was so wonderful to hear, like how much value was put onto all the things that I had done in the past. And, you know, and it did work really well, and it still does. So
I find it quite fascinating as therapists, or just in general, really, sometimes how when we're in organisations, how we can be restricted or blinkered because we're just in that system, aren't we? And we don't really necessarily know what's going on out there. We kind of have an idea, but we don't fully know or realise that it exists until we take that step. And then
there's a story, isn't there, that you're told about the culture that you're in, that's the be all and end all. And that, you know, whereas actually, I mean, there's so much different. I mean, it's even still evolving now, the sort of work I'm getting now, which things I didn't even know were possible. So I'm actually still developing my practice now, which is also important, isn't it? Because you don't want to stagnate in at any point doing this work. It's really important to keep learning and challenging and all that. And that kind of happens quite naturally. Obviously, as well, I do CPD as well, but, you know, it also does happen naturally in the sort of work that tends to come.
And do you think that work, because I've kind of had a look at your website and seen some of the stuff on social media, do you feel like you kind of put yourself out there quite a bit? Because I feel like you kind of, from reading your website and stuff, you just seem to kind of, I just got the impression that you were kind of maybe putting yourself out there a little
bit. That's really interesting, because I don't feel like I put myself out there hardly at all.
Okay.
That's really interesting. And like I'm glad you've asked me to do this, because I like the opportunity to reflect as well. It's really useful. And one of the reasons I said yes to doing it is because I want to get better at putting myself out there. Because there's one of the things I'm developing alongside my therapy work is I'm developing doing training and CPD courses. Because I used to do some training in NHS and things like that. And in the last year or so, I've started to do some training again. So that's the part of my business that I need to learn how to publicise. But I think probably what you're observing is that I've done a lot of writing stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And I do, I guess I do put that out there, but yeah. I don't put it out there in a way, as a way to attract clients. It's not, well, it's not intentional. It's not like, oh, I do this and then you can come and see me. And it doesn't really work like that either. Cause I think about this a lot because my main specialist area is working with people with chronic physical health problems. Mm-hmm. And that's a very complex area. And it, you know, it's quite difficult work depending on where the person's at and how complex their health problems are. And so I do some of that work, but it's certainly not what I spend my whole working time doing. And I wouldn't want it to be either. Yeah. So I kind of, the writing's almost like it's not separate. It's related, but it came first in a way. It's like, yeah. I started writing when I was still quite new in the NHS because I never saw myself as a writer as such. And I wasn't deliberately writing. That a coincidence occurred, which you might ask me about. But, since then I've just wrote bits of articles here and there, and you know, I like writing. I find it enjoyable, you know.
But it's, and I suppose, not deliberate. That's what I think of putting yourself out there. I think that is a way of putting yourself out there.
Yeah,
you know,
sharing. I guess I'm trying to share my knowledge, and I'm trying to, you know, because I think the field that I specialize in is there's such a dearth of actual people who know what they're talking about, and people who have, you know, complex health problems quite often don't encounter any health professionals who understand what they're going through at all, even the ones who are supposed to, because they're specialists, you know, often they don't understand. And so that's like absolutely heartbreaking. I've experienced it myself, so I have like a really deep empathy for that. And I think it's so important for somebody like me who has kind of a personal knowledge, but also professional knowledge, that I do something with that information, because it's almost like I feel like I have to do it. I'd be wrong not to, because I don't want to sound like really self-righteous or something, but somebody's got to do something about it. You know,
absolutely.
What I mean?
But I thought that was one of the things that was interesting about Therapist Connect was actually kind of lots of people doing this fantastic work that no one was actually here, or people were hearing out, but there was groups of people hearing about different things. And actually trying to kind of elevate that and kind of go, look at this person, look this, you might find this interesting, or look at this over here, I think is a fantastic opportunity on social
media. Well, you certainly
media.
Achieved that. I mean, that's what I like so much about what you've done. No, because, you know, it's been absolutely brilliant what you've done, because that's what I personally want. I want to be able to see what other people, what good other people are doing, rather than have discussions about negative stuff, because there's plenty of difficulties in our profession. And, you know, you can talk about those also, but it's so much better to find out what everyone's getting up to, isn't it? And like learn about who's in the area. I mean, you know, we're in the same city, aren't we? We've never met yet. Maybe one day we'll be allowed to meet.
When we're allowed.
I know. But you know, it's just so nice to get to know people a little bit and sort of know who's around and what they're up to. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it. So.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. I think some things going on your doorstep, or little groups of communities of therapists who are there discussing and would love to meet other therapists, but it just hasn't happened for one reason or another. So
you've created a platform for people knowing more, and I think that's really great.
And it's been lovely for me just kind of being able to actually speak to people, because I feel like it was such a whirlwind at the beginning. It was almost facilitation rather than involvement. Actually,
it went off really quick, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah, because we were waiting for it. You see, we needed it.
It was lovely. It was really nice. So, do you want to tell me a little bit about how would you describe your therapeutic approach then, your modality, or your call it?
Well, I would describe it as integrative. I know some of this language is debated, isn't it? Whether it's eclectic or whether I call it integrative, because I consider that I integrate various different approaches. But the way that, I mean, my approach is really heavily influenced by having worked in the NHS. And over time, as the culture changed in NHS mental health, there was much more pressure to train in CBT and to train in IPT. And basically, we were at points told you have to do this training, because I was person-centered trained and I loved that approach. And I was basically made to do some of these other trainings.
Were you resistant?
Oh, yes. Yeah, and I won't get into any of that because that could go on all day. But let's just say I did the CBT training. I made sure they sent me on the highest quality possible certificate course in the Northwest. So I did it at Salford. It was really good. And I did get some really good things from that. But I like to reflect now I'm out of private practice and meeting individual people's needs, how little I use CBT is quite interesting. I do use it very occasionally, you know, but I coming back to the question, I consider that I'm, and I'm sure every good therapist does this, but my job is to meet the client where they are. And so I individualize all the things I've got to offer to them. And that's, you know, and that's highly complex stuff. And it doesn't just involve skills and strategies and theory, does it? It involves language and, you know, speech. And it's fascinating because obviously you can tell I'm not from Liverpool. But like, I'm really aware of how my accent changes. I've lived here for a really long time. My accent changes like naturally according to who I'm working with. And it's not in a deliberate way. Obviously, I wouldn't do that. Much as I love the Scouse accent, I have never picked one up. But like, you go into where the person is, don't you? And I think, so I had all these extra trainings that I did. And then I chose to do some mindfulness training, because that felt like something that would be good for me as well as good for my clients. So I did that. That's heavily influenced my practice. And I have a mindfulness practice myself now. And that really helps me now during this period of history as well. I have a lot of clients who, I mean, like I don't ever say to my clients, this is how I work and we're going to do this, this and that. I wait for them to tell me what they want. And a lot of my clients will say things to me like, oh, I want to learn how to be more present, or I want to, you know, a lot of them don't know they're talking about mindfulness. They have never heard of it, but they're asking me for that. And so we'll do a bit of work on that. And so a lot of my clients do mindfulness alongside the therapy. And that's quite a profound thing. And then the other side of my practice that's kind of started from personal experience and from working in primary care, where a lot of the clients coming through had physical health problems. And I had quite serious physical health problems also. So over time, I've evolved a way of working with that. And as you probably saw on my website, I had a period of time where I was a patron of a charity. So I've written a lot of resources for them and about different things. And I kind of consider myself, I call myself an expert patient. I know that's a bit of a, I don't know if everyone even understands what that means now, but basically it just means a person who lives with health problems, who self-manages their health problems without drugs, you know, so as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And so I live what I sometimes, not always, not obviously not all my clients have health problems. And some of them haven't got a clue that I've got health problems because they've never Googled me and they've never like read all my stuff. But I can work quite well with people who are dealing with some pretty challenging things. But I also work with general, you know, I work across the board with all kinds of different issues because I prefer to do that. I don't want to just work with one area. So yeah, so it's kind of just developed over time, as it does for everybody, I suppose, into this kind of mixture of whatever somebody needs. It seems to work quite well, but I like to observe how little of the more manualized therapies I actually need, because my clients don't need me to use them. And that's what I find interesting. So basically what I'm saying is I was trained in person-centered therapy. Most of the time, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know, you know, you're not surprised by that, are you? At all, of course. And, you know, no therapist is, but you know, if you look out there in the world, you'd think, well, what's she talking about? That can't be possible. It doesn't work and blah, blah, blah. But it really does work. And now I'm out of a structured organization where I only have X amount of sessions. I still can't believe I can work with some of my clients for as long as they need me to. It's so great. It's like, I love it. Not all of them, because some have had limitations, but.
It's wonderful, isn't it? I find that, particularly in private practices, is just actually that it's just open to as much as they need, you know. And that, you know, sometimes that will be a couple of sessions, you know, and sometimes it might be working over years potentially, you know, with people. And I think that's wonderful, you know, that people can get that opportunity. I was just thinking then when you were talking about describing your practice and your approach, and it's so interesting. I've not done that many interviews so far, but I've spoken to a few different people, but they've all labeled their approach so differently, you know, existential, pluralistic, person-centered, integrative, whatever it is. They've all labeled it, but nearly all of them have said
the same.
Meeting the person, you know, in the moment, where they're coming from, in the here and now. It's just which I found absolutely fascinating.
Which actually really is. I mean, it's person-centered, isn't it? Because even though you might be bringing in tools, you're offering them to an individual person, and you know, it's completely up to them whether they take them on or not.
Absolutely, so
I do consider that to still be person-centered in spirit. Yeah. But then a lot of the work I do is pretty purely person-centered.
Yeah.
Because there's no need, let's be honest, there's actually no need for any of the faffing a lot of the time. Because what people need, they need the space. They need to be heard. It's so simple. It's not simple because most humans can't do it, but it's the simplest thing, isn't it, that we're actually doing, is hearing someone on a deep level. You know?
And it's interesting, isn't it, that it is a simple concept.
Yes.
It's such a simple concept. And I think so. Sometimes when I'm with students and stuff, that I think sometimes before they go out on placement, they maybe get a little bit frustrated because they're kind of like, well, what else? What else is there? But like what you were saying there, the wonderfulness of it is that actually you can go to this amazing depth with this very, very simple concept and simple idea. It's not simple to do, but it's very, it's simple to understand.
Really, you know? Powerful. It's really, really powerful. And often, I mean, the sad thing is, of course, that you've probably experienced this, often you'll meet people who've either had lots of therapy before or they've waited a very long time for their therapy. And they come and speak to you and they're like, no one's ever listened to me like this before. And then it makes me cry when someone says that to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're in their 50s or something and no one's ever heard them. You know, it's really awful, isn't it? You know,
absolutely. After they've been directed to a website that tries to teach them how to think in a different way. And then all of a sudden someone's actually trying to pay attention to what they're trying to say.
And that in itself, like straight away, there's a transformation that can occur there. I mean, sometimes it's actually quite, it's frightening for them and for the therapist, isn't it? That within one or two sessions, they can start to feel very different just because they've been, at last, they've been heard.
It's
so healing and powerful. And of course, we'll probably get on talking about this, but like working in a remote way like this, it is different. I mean, you can, it does work. So that's really good. It does work, but it's different than actually being in the room with a person as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that interesting dynamic as well is maybe if you've been working face to face with somebody, but now all of a sudden, you're online and all of a sudden, you know, the context is different and they're seeing some of your house and you're seeing some of their house. And it changes the dynamics a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I think some of my clients have commented on that because obviously I'm making sure they're okay and asking them how's it going, you know? And I think because if you have already worked with them, they know you, they know your voice. And like I'm doing a lot of my work on the phone actually, because I gave my clients the option of either or, because I've done both before, so I was quite lucky, I'd already had a bit of practice. So most of mine are working on the phone, which is different again, but they you just fall into the rhythm because you know how each other talks, you know how much, I know I'm talking a lot now, but when I'm working with a client, obviously, I'm not talking at this level. So they're used to that. They're used to, you know, how much space is normally in our interactions and stuff like that. So, it does work, but it is different. So,
fantastic. Changing the conversation slightly, because you've been, it's nice to see actually that you've been in practice for so long, but you're still so passionate about therapy and, you know, which is, I think is fantastic. What advice would you give to somebody if they were coming into the profession now or thinking about training?
This is one of the hard questions that you let me know about before. I do have an answer for this because sometimes people do ask me, you know, like I've had clients who've said to me, oh, you know, I'm going to train as a counsellor now, you know, and then I'm like, oh, no. So my answer, I'll just tell you what I say to them because it's a contradictory answer. It's like, A, it's the best job in the world. And if you really, truly love it, it's amazing. It's like the best, most satisfying job. And B, you must know there's no work. You must realise there's no paid jobs. And, you know, if in order to build a private practice, it can take a very long time. And so I do, you know, I hate it when someone asks me this question because it makes me squirm, but I feel like you have to be honest with people. The amount of people I've met who or seen on forums and things who are doing their training and no one's ever told them that there's no magic jobs out there.
Yeah.
It's just terrible. And, you know, and then the heartbreak for people when they finish their training, they're being forced into private practice, probably should really probably do that straight from training. I think a lot of people feel like they have to do that. And it's just really hard. It takes a very long time. I think, like I said at the beginning, the reason I kind of fell on my feet with it was because I'd already done all the things that a person needs to do to do that. Whereas if you've just come out of your training, you might be very good at your job, but you don't necessarily have all the support and the backup and the knowledge and the, you know, all the risk management skills, all the things that you need to work on your own in isolation. Because it's pretty tricky, isn't it? I mean, it can be. And I think, and that's what I say to people. So, you know, it's horrible, but it's true, isn't it?
And I think you're right. I think it's important to be honest about that, really. And I know there's a lot of campaigning going on at the moment around employment opportunities for therapists. But, you know, it's not at a stage yet where, you know, unlike other professions say that, you know, not that you're guaranteed a job, but there is a lot of jobs out there waiting for you. Not like that.
It's actually got worse. When I was in the NHS, the way that things went, that the original team was just counsellors. And then by the time I left, without getting into any of the reasons, because we're not here for that, but by the time I left, there was hardly any of us left. We'd basically pushed out. And so there is some counsellors in the NHS now, but they're very few and far between. And you have to have, that's another myth, isn't it? People think, oh, I can go in as a PWP and then train and get through. It doesn't work like that, because in the NHS, you have to have the IAP recognised qualifications, which are extra qualifications, and they're not necessarily what you've just been training to do, especially if you're person-centred. Yeah. And so, you, in a way, I've seen a lot of debate around that as well, because I think newly qualified people, obviously, they need to make a living, especially if they're, you know, starting out in their career. Sometimes they'll do, like, almost a deal with the devil. They're like, oh, well, I'll do this training because it's the only way I can get a job. But this work is not like that. You do what feels right most of us do anyway. So,
well, it's challenging, I think, to be forced into an approach that you don't believe in, you know, for employment, you know, and I think that is difficult. And I think particularly if you are being trained initially in person-centered and then you are, you know, pushed into doing a different approach which you don't want to do in an organization, I think it's challenging for people, because the way you approach person-centered training and the way you live it, don't you? You don't you don't just do it, you live it. So it's a bit of a mismatch then to try and say, actually, forget that
throw all that self-awareness out the window. It's really tricky, but it is the best job in the world. And I love it. And I'm so grateful for so many things, I won't bore you with, that I am still managing to do it. You know, it's just wonderful. So.
Be passionate about it as well, which is great.
Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. So is there any other rewards or challenges you think that you've maybe had, or you think that there is in therapy?
Well, I think the main reward is what I kind of alluded to before, which is that it's one of the only jobs in the world where every single encounter you have, you get something out of it. And, you know, like a lot of jobs, there's very little, you can see very little outcome from a lot of jobs, can't you? You get very little feedback. But in the work that we do, there's like micro moments of that every single session with a person. And it's just so uplifting. It's like, you know, like if you're having a bit of a bad day and then you go into work and see your clients, I mean, it's just amazing. It's like so completely affirming all the time. And I'm not, you know, that might sound really silly and flippant, but I know you know what I mean,
yeah,
as a therapist, that you could be working with someone who's quite severely depressed, but within that session, there'll be something that they have got from that. There'll be some humour, there'll be something that makes all of that worthwhile. And, you know, and it's just, that's just great. I mean, it's so rare, isn't it? So that's the main reward, I think. And obviously the greater thing is just seeing people go from where they started to where they are, and then going back out into the world and like having got to where they want to get to, wherever that is, you know.
It's the privilege to be part of that, isn't it?
Totally. And the secrecy of it all as well. That's related, because that's what I also struggle with, that sometimes you're working with like these, everyone is amazing. Every human is amazing. And everybody's working on some amazing stuff. Sometimes there'll be things that I want so badly to tell someone else about, you know, whether it's a small scale thing that's an individual achievement or whether I'm actually working with someone really impressive and, you know, even slightly famous, you know, can't tell anyone. I find that really challenging. And, you know, I am one of these therapists who takes confidentiality completely seriously.
Yeah, so
I know some people have more fluid bands, but I don't discuss my clients with anybody, you know, and my supervisor maybe, but you know, even don't tell my supervisor the names of my clients. So but you know, you sometimes you go and you go, oh my God, I've got to tell you what this person's doing. You just don't.
Yeah.
So you've got to keep it all in. So that's quite challenging. I mean, I can do it, don't get me wrong, I do it, but I sometimes find it hard. And the other thing I find the most challenging about the work is it's not just because I'm outside the NHS, because it also exists if you're in the NHS, but what I find really difficult is when I'm working with people who can't access the other services that they need. So whether they've got like quite a severe and enduring mental health problem and they're trying to get into a specialist service, or whether I'm working with someone with an undiagnosed physical health problem. I mean, so part of my job, again, it's evolved because I was in the NHS, and actually my first job in the NHS, I forgot to mention, was getting people off tranquilizers and sleeping tablets. That was actually a specific role that I was employed with someone else to do, because that was the target at the time. They're not really interested in that anymore. So, from that, I did a lot of GP liaison work. And so now I do, you know, I do referral letters and things for people, because that's what I used to do a lot of in the NHS. So if somebody's trying to get a service and they're having terrible trouble doing it, then not all therapists do this, but I would maybe write them a letter of referral, or, you know, I have some ability to do that. So sometimes I can help with that. Sometimes I can help them get past the obstacle that they might have. But other times, all I can do is support them and try and like help them to help themselves whilst they're waiting for some quite important treatment, you know. And I find that really difficult, because obviously the NHS is massively under-resourced. Maybe everybody knows that now, but a few weeks ago, people didn't know that. You know, it's been upsetting me for decades, but the average person in the public did not know how under-resourced the NHS is. And, you know, it is, and it has been for a very long time. And so that happens a lot. You know, it's not because the people in the services don't want to help. It's because they haven't got the resources to help people often. So I find that really horrible. It's very upsetting.
And frustrating as well, isn't it? You know, that actually there is only so much an individual person, when I mean a person, I mean the client, can do in their own circumstances. Yeah, and actually sometimes context or organisations or funding or whatever it is actually is the thing that's holding people back, and not actually the fact that the person themselves.
I think that's sometimes why it is appropriate, with the experience I have, for me to support that occasionally, because especially if the person's also depressed because of their circumstances, it's, as you say, really hard for them to fight that system, you know. And so occasionally I will support them with that, because I feel like I have to, I can't not do that, you know. And I think that maybe quite a few people listening go, oh, I would never do that, that's not very person-centered. But again, that comes from my experience, you know, it comes from working in that setting and being used to doing that.
And I think potentially using your experience from the NHS, you know, actually that letter of support could actually make a massive difference potentially to that person and their life. Yeah.
Sometimes it gets the benefits that they've been rejected from, you know, it can be extremely powerful, you know. So, so that's when I guess I take some of the power back, don't I, by doing that. So, well, this is really distressing. What can I actually do here? Yeah. And when I do that, by the way, I do that in a collaborative way. I don't write the letter. I do it with the person. So I ask them what they want me to put in it. And then, you know, and then I let them read it before it's sent. It's not me taking the expert role. It's me basically, actually, like I used to do with GPs in the NHS, it's me manipulating my position. And, you know, I'll do things that I never do in everyday life. Like I'll write all my qualifications along the bottom of the letter just to whip them with the, you know, I don't never do that. There's no need to do that with clients. But if you're sending a letter to a consultant, you've got to do it, haven't you? So that's when, you know, I know how to play that game. So that's what I do. And I quite enjoy that.
I can see.
It's good.
Fantastic. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
So we've touched on this briefly. We've talked a little bit about the Therapist Connect hashtag. And I was just wondering, how you'd experienced it, because it did feel like it was quite a bit of a quite successful. Yeah. And just your understanding and experience of social media in general, really, yeah, as a therapist, I'd be quite interested to hear about that.
Yeah. Okay. So I tend to use different social media in very distinct ways, and that's just for my own kind of well-being, really. So Twitter is actually the main one I use, the only one I use professionally, actually. So obviously, as you've seen, I've got a mental health and well-being feed on Twitter myself. And so I'm on Twitter and mostly follow advocates of people who have got chronic illness and other mental health professionals and just people of interest, really, in the field. So on Facebook, I don't have any professional presence on Facebook because I personally feel like Facebook's more social, so I keep myself very private on there. And then I've got an Instagram that, again, is just for myself. So Twitter's the place I spend most of my social media work time, I guess. And yeah, I get a huge amount from that. I've made some really important connections on there previous to what you've done, which are really bizarre. Like, obviously, international people that you're never likely to meet in real life. Like, one of the pieces of writing I've done in somebody's book was because I made a connection on Twitter. Yeah. So that's really good. And these things tend, because you said before that you noticed that I do put a lot out there, but I don't usually do it in a calculated way. So I'm very bad at asking for things. I'm trying to get better, actually, because I think I'd probably ask you for something since you're doing this, but I find it quite difficult to do that. So what tends to happen is that people have seen things I've done and then they've come to me and gone, oh, you know, seen this, I like this, do you want to do that? And I was like, oh, okay, that's nice. So that's happened quite a lot. So I've made a lot of connections like that. But it wasn't until you did yours, there wasn't a cohesive community, I wouldn't say. There's a group of people who were also involved in your hashtag, who do a lot of, you know, who were already having good conversations. So I recognize some of the names, but I think what you've done is kind of bring it together, which is really good. And it's, I don't know when you did that, because was it end of January?
It was beginning of January. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
When you did it, it was just, I have no concepts of time. Sorry.
It's okay.
It was just really great. It was like, almost like that's what was needed somehow.
I mean, I still find it a bit bizarre that it even happened. And I said this to somebody else the other day, that it was a tweet which didn't have a great deal of thought go into it, to be completely honest. It was just a little idea, and I was really expecting, you know, five or six people, you know, to kind of respond you know, and a bit more networking and whatever. And then not only was the original tweet successful, but I think, as you say, the hashtag became, actually, just use this hashtag and actually you can talk about anything to do with therapy that other therapists might be interested in.
Yeah, and it's worked really well.
Yeah, and I think...
The tone of it is quite different, because I think the other thing I should have said, is that although my Facebook profile is private, I'm in a lot of therapy Facebook groups, and what I'm finding is what you're doing is very different to them. There's some really good stuff going on there. There's I'm sure you're aware of some of the groups. There's some really good positive stuff, but it's somehow, I don't know, it's different. It's got a different tone to it somehow. It's a lot more problem based than whereas what you're doing is a lot more, I don't know, knowledge based and kind of supportive
community
and sharing. It's much more what I need, I think.
Yeah.
Than any of the other things that I might interact with. Yeah.
Which is great. And I think, you know, all of those things are necessary, aren't they? We need, you know, spaces to critique things and look at things and examine things. But, you know, we also need to kind of collaborate and be a community as well when we need to be. So I think both of the things are valid, but we might seek different things out at different times, I suppose.
Yeah, but it has been really useful, and as I say, it must have been needed, otherwise it wouldn't have been so quick to take off. Yeah.
Well, just kind of following on from that point then, one of the things that came out of it, and a lot of therapists have messaged me about this, is that idea of being connected to each other, and that sense of community. And I just wondered, what were your kind of thoughts or experience around feeling connected to the wider therapists community, working in private practice now, compared to, say, when you were in the NHS?
Yeah, well, it's been quite interesting to observe how little I missed the team that I was in, but I realised that's because the team had didn't exist anymore. I mean, it did literally exist, but the way that it had been managed, there was no team and we couldn't access each other's support anymore. So I didn't miss that at all, which was really shocking to me. It's like, oh my God, but you used to be a team of 40 people and now you don't, you know, don't even, never look back. I'm still friends with some of those people, by the way, obviously. And especially the ones who've also escaped from there. So, so I do have, I thought a lot about this because that was a really important question that you asked me. So I thought about all the different places that I have, like little networks of people. And I've got some really good friends who are at similar stages in their career, because I feel that's quite important as well, because there's a vast difference, isn't there, between newly qualified and someone at the level I'm at, and you know, different needs and different support needs and everything like that. So I've got a friend that we kind of meet once a month online and just chat about whatever it is we need. And then I've got a couple of friends who we like meet, they live in different parts of the country, but we meet up and go out socially. And our practices and our work-life balance are so similar. It's really amazing. Like we're all quite successful in terms of our work, but we all work 3 days a week. No, none of us work on Fridays. We've all got a really great work-life balance. It was so nice to find them. I found them on Twitter and LinkedIn. One of them is on both, but that's how I met them, you know. And now we're really good friends and we support each other. And, you know, often it's got nothing to do with therapy. We're just in a very similar mindset.
Yeah.
There's some local therapists that I like know and meet up with. I've got some friends in some of the buildings. I work in the eco offices. And so there's lots of counselors in there. So make friends with some of them. So some socialize with some of them. Another thing that I am involved in, which I get a lot out of, which again is international, but there's a couple of really great podcasts that I listen to really regularly. I don't know if you've come across my favorite therapy podcast. Have you heard of it? It's, tell me more about that. It's called Say More About That. Sorry. By a man in Portland, Oregon. He's called Jeff Gunther and he is hilarious. He's so good. Because he's actually risking his license, because you know in the States it's very, like, it's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's so honest, and he does a lot of really great open talks about what it's like to be a therapist. And he's absolutely brilliant. So I listen to his podcast every week.
I'm going to have to listen to that now.
It's really good. It's really, especially at the moment, because he's doing some about what's it like in this pandemic, you know.
Yeah.
But he has like guests on who are other therapists and different things. So I get a lot from that. So that's like a bit of an international kind of community. And then, I don't feel as isolated as I thought I would. But I think sometimes, you know, I have to work quite hard at that to make sure I've got enough, contacts. And I'm just about to start peer supervision with an ex-colleague, stroke friend of mine, partly to get, you know, support through this different time as well. Yeah. So, yeah, I've got quite a lot of good.
I was going to say that does sound like there's quite a lot of different elements to that, really. And I think that's a really good point. And I know speaking to students sometimes when they're about to qualify and they're kind of like worried about, because they're quite supported through training and then coming out of it. And I often try and kind of explain to them that actually you can get that support from, it doesn't have to cost money necessarily. You have your supervision, but as you say, you can have peer support, you can access, you know, other groups and things like that, that it doesn't necessarily, you can try and feel more connected without actually feeling like you have to have the course students around you.
And it's meeting like-minded therapists as well. A couple of people, I think I was a couple of years into private practice and there was a couple of quite innovative, newly qualified people who actually approached me and said, do you want to meet up for a coffee? I'm setting up on a just fancy chat. And I actually really liked that because they didn't want anything from me apart from to get to know people. And it was really great. And so that's the way, obviously, to make connections for referring back and forth. And, you know, if you take opportunities like that on and make them happen, then you quite quickly end up with a bit of a network of people. But I don't have a huge network of people I refer to. I could do with like getting to know more people locally for sure, you know. But Liverpool's a very small place, isn't it?
It certainly is. And then the therapy community in Liverpool is even smaller.
Exactly. Yeah, so often you already do know them, but you don't necessarily, So yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it? But but this is what you're doing is definitely a good part of all of that now.
Thank you. And I hope so. And I think hopefully, I think with the podcast idea, it was kind of actually kind of talking to therapists who were in practice and kind of putting out those stories out there, really, to kind of get a clearer sense of what we're doing and kind of the things that we can share with other people, really. Is there anything that you think that we could be doing as a profession to kind of help us connect more as therapists, or pay us all properly might be one?
Well, do you know what? I think I'm not sure if you're still going to ask me about what I think the greatest challenge is to the profession, because that's the answer for me personally, is working together in whatever ways we can to try and be valued more. And and the word profession, I think, obviously this is a profession, you know, it's certainly a profession that I chose to go into and trained to do, but I don't think it's seen as a profession by a lot of people in it necessarily behave like it is a profession. And I don't mean that in any derogatory way, but I mean the volunteering culture that there is and the way that people are prepared to work for next to no money quite a lot of the time. And, you know, sometimes that's because they have to make money. I understand that. But there's a lot of, I feel like this is a really major issue. And it's kind of popped up a bit more, hasn't it, since the lockdown, where there's organizations that are setting themselves up to help people's mental health. And they're expecting counsellors to work for nothing.
Yeah.
And that is outrageous and absolutely disgusting. And I really think it's going to damage this element of our profession even more, because then that sets up an expectation that we do. Why would we do this for nothing? This is such a precious thing that we do.
And I think this is a really important discussion point. And I think there is people who kind of argue, well, I want to volunteer. And I think there is a difference between somebody who is, you know, got enough money, has maybe got a job and wants to do a few hours volunteering, and approaching an organization, compared to a culture of an expectation everybody will volunteer.
We definitely got that culture, haven't we? And I think the EAPs, which is where a lot of people start their private practice, because it's a way of having some of the rates, some of those pay are absolutely appalling. I mean, £20 an hour when, I don't know, the average percentage of expenses in your first couple of years of private practice, probably going to be 40 to 50%. I don't know. It certainly was when I was setting up my private practice. And you're getting, so you end up with less than £10 an hour. We've spent how many thousands of pounds on training? It's just not right, is it? So that, for me, that's where we need to kind of find a way to come together. And that, to me, is the greatest challenge, because if we look at how we're valued compared to some other professions in mental health, and, you know, believe me, I worked in the NHS, I've met a lot of other mental health professionals in other roles, and I've not met any who I thought were better therapists than me and my colleagues. Yet some of them are on salaries that are four times the amount. That's not right. You know, so there's a valuing problem there, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, and I think we need to sort that out, because if we don't, it continues to get worse. It's dragging pay down. No one's ever going to be able to make a living. And, of course, this whole class thing is coming back into it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's becoming, again, I mean, this is just horrendous. Like, from when I started, and it's kind of, it almost looked like it was getting a bit better, didn't it? It was becoming more accessible as a profession for different people with different backgrounds. And it almost feels like it's going back again. It's becoming that hideous, white, middle-class, middle-aged woman thing. Again, which it's just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong on so many levels.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, I am some of those things myself, but it doesn't mean I don't have a duty to point out that that's not how it should be.
And it's that idea of diversity, isn't it? And actually having a wealth of different people. And surely the more diverse we are as a profession, you know, the more valuable we can be.
Exactly. We have to represent the population of people that might want to come and see us, you know. And that, I mean, that's changed a bit, but I really don't think it's enough. I think a lot of work needs. So that is related to the valuing, because if it's hard to make any money, people can't go into the profession in the first place unless they're privileged. And so we need to redress that in order to get that mix, you know. So I feel really passionate about all of that kind of stuff.
So my next question is going to be, you've had a book published.
I did, yes.
I kind of think kind of fits in with your specialism that you've kind of talked about before. Yeah. And it's about chronic fatigue and ME. Could you tell me a little bit about how you came to write that?
Well, again, that was another strange coincidence. And that actually came before the specialism in a way, because what happened was, I've thought about this morning to make sure I got it in the right order, because it was quite a long time ago that I wrote that. It's about 12 years ago now. So what happened was, I knew someone in the NHS who knew I had been writing some stuff just for myself. I must have just been talking about it or something. Both of these people, it's very strange, they both knew this lady who was an editor of a series of books, and they were looking for someone to write a book about ME. I knew far too much about that illness at that point, let's just say. And it was really amazing. I mean, I was like blown over by being asked to do it, but it was really challenging, because the book is not for people who have chronic fatigue ME. It's for the friends and family of the people. That's what the series is called, Friends and Family. And there's other illnesses in the series written by other people. Anyway, so I wrote it, and it was really useful for me to write it, as well as, you know, I enjoyed writing it, obviously, and people have found it helpful. But what was the best thing for me was, it helped me to understand more about why some of the people in my life had struggled so much with me being ill. And that was really, really good. It was painful, but it was helpful. So, so, because at the first I was like, oh, I'm not writing a book for those people. You know, why should I write a book for people who haven't managed to help me? but it helped me to process that, you know.
So
I did that, and that was published, and it was bizarre. It wasn't straightforward, of course, because publishing never is straightforward, is it?
No.
It was a bit disappointing. Like, it hasn't really been publicised that well, and I for a long time, I wasn't well enough to publicise it myself. Really ironic, but I wasn't. And so it hasn't really had the reach that it might have done. But since then, I've done, like, various other little things. I've been in another couple of books, and I write a lot of my own articles now, because I tend to find that, you know, I can have complete control over... I had complete control over the book, don't get me wrong, I did that. But I was thinking about writing another book, but then... I know some people who are like proper novelists and things, and I've asked their advice. I was like, well, you know, would you self-publish or get published by a publishing company or whatever? And it's just a minefield. It's so complicated. And I personally feel like because you don't make money out of having a book, by the way. Anyone who's listening thinks I made loads of money from writing that. I didn't make any money from it. And that isn't why I wrote it either. So, but you don't make money from it. So you've got to do it for the joy of it, but also for, like I said, about the talks that I'm doing, about sharing your knowledge, you know. And I can share my knowledge by writing an article and publishing it on my own website, can't I?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way I've gone now, but now I'm moving into doing talks, because I love that also, and obviously you can reach big groups of people all at once. So now we're in lockdown, I'm gonna try maybe and do some of that online as well.
Fantastic.
But yeah, so I've kind of evolved from that. And and over the time, like, I was quite ill then. I don't have ME anymore. That's a whole other story. Don't even ask me that. That'll open up a whole massive can of worms. But anyway, I do still have other health problems. And so, you know, I still use a lot of the strategies and things that I need to kind of manage my own health. But a lot of the tools that I have to use, self-care stuff, pacing, you know, all kinds of things. Not only are they perfect for surviving a lockdown, like mentally and physically, but also they're great for working in private practice, because I have to have really good boundaries and limits and, you know, really good support systems and all kinds of things to manage, you know. So it turns out that going through a lot of very difficult health stuff, you can come out the other end with some really good skills. So that's good. That's really
there's handy. Learning from it as you despite the challenges.
So I'm just continuing to write, and I've had an idea, actually. I've been speaking to my supervisor just yesterday about this, about the fact that we're in a global pandemic, and one of the big triggers for fatigue-related illness is viruses. I don't know how much you know about that, but for a lot of people, they'd never fully recover from a viral infection of the level of COVID-19. And so I'm starting to think, you know, what can I do with my knowledge around fatigue,
because
all the illnesses that I have experienced myself, but also kind of fit together in people, there's normally multiple diagnoses, they all have similarities in the fatigue and in the management stuff. And so I have a lot of expertise in that, so I'm starting to think, oh, hang on, maybe I've got something to offer
Yeah.
Not right now, maybe, but, you know,
when. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? It's going to be the longer term impact on people and groups of people that this may potentially have.
Yeah.
You know, any advice that they can get in terms of having to manage the repercussions or the consequences of what's happened, I think is going to be very valuable to people, I think, really.
Yeah. So it's not very nice to have expertise in such a horrible area, but it's at least I've got something to maybe. You can do something with it, can't you? Yeah, so yeah, I mean, I do want to write another book and I've got a lot of ideas, but I don't really think it's the best place to put my energies.
Great. Well, I think that's all of my questions, really. How did you feel being on the podcast? Was it okay?
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
It's good. It's been a really lovely chat getting to know you a little bit better. And I do hope we, since we live quite close, I do hope we actually meet face to face at some point. We'll have a coffee or something.
Imagine being able to be out there.
It'll be very strange, won't it? We'll all be like.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Therapist Connect podcast. Go to www.therapist-connect.com for more discussions and debates.